After yet another deadly high school shooting, looking at gun violence in America as a public health crisis. Just ahead, what the nation's doctors have to say about the issue. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to get our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, the American Medical Association weighs in on this nation's gun violence epidemic. We'll speak with the group's president-elect as she appears in Jacksonville this week. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, it's also National EMT Week. America's EMTs and trauma surgeons also have a lot to say about gun injuries and gun deaths in this country. We'll hear from them as well. Plus, Culpepper later in the hour as the Jaguars get ready for those off-season workouts. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, there's been yet another round of gun violence at an American high school. 10 people were killed Friday morning, 9 students and 1 teacher, in Santa Fe, Texas, when a junior student there opened fire on his classmates. On Friday morning, Santa Fe High became the site of the 22nd U.S. school shooting in just the first 20 weeks of this year, one every single week this year, and more. Now, just a few weeks ago, a handful of the students at this high school, which is southeast of Houston, had taken part in the nationwide April 20th walkout to protest gun violence in schools. The violence would soon come to them. This scourge of gun violence in America has reached into every state, including here in Florida, of course. Actually, this week, physicians here in Northeast Florida will discuss gun violence as a public health issue. The president-elect of the American Medical Association, along with the president of the Florida Medical Association, together will open the 2018 Future of Healthcare Conference today at the downtown Prime Osborne Convention Center. In addition to gun violence, also on the agenda, a look at the nation's opioid epidemic, mental health, and obesity. Dr. Barbara McEnany is president-elect of the American Medical Association, and she's going to be giving a keynote address at the conference. She joins us now here in studio with a preview of that discussion and takes your calls. Dr. McEnany, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be here.
And what are your questions for the president-elect of the American Medical Association? She'll be speaking in Jacksonville this week on gun violence and the opioid epidemic, national crises with local impacts. Get on the line right now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. We also welcome your comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page, where we are already seeing you comment there. Dr. McEnany, your talk is titled National Crises, Local Impact. And let's talk about the opioid epidemic in a moment. The other crises on your agenda, gun violence. And sadly, it's timely. Not a week, in fact, goes by in this country, it seems, without a deadly mass shooting. Just the other day, Santa Fe High School in Santa Fe, Texas, became the latest site of students getting shot down in their high school. And so I'm curious to begin by asking you, what's the position of the American Medical Association on this public health crisis, which I think physicians have long considered it to be? What's the AMA's position on this issue?
I think you just stated the AMA's position. We look at this as a public health issue. We do not look at it as a Second Amendment issue. If we had an illness that we're striking down as many of our children as we see from gun violence, the entire country would be up in arms. We would say, let's study this. Let's look at what's causing this illness that's killing our kids, and we would do something about it. But currently, we're not even really allowed to have our National Institute of Health study this issue. So part of AMA policy is the first thing we have to do is to figure out the causes, the root causes that this is having, and develop programs that can address that.
Let's talk about the reasons why the National Institutes of Health isn't able to fully study this issue and gather the data that you, as the leading organization for physicians, would theoretically need to address this.
Well, there was a prohibition on giving funding to the NIH to look at this issue. And that was put in as a very specific amendment that we opposed.
The Dickey Amendment, it was called, yes.
And we oppose that and would like to see that removed so that we can start to study this issue.
And if that amendment were to be repealed, the late Senator Dickey, it's my understanding on his deathbed, he actually said he regretted the passage of that amendment. If that amendment were to be repealed, what would that mean then for further study on this?
Well, like any public health issue, it requires funding to look at what's going on and what are the causes, and to be able to come up with some creative solutions to this. The AMA has a long track record of addressing public health issues. For example, as we looked at the number of people who were dying in car accidents, we didn't ban cars. We came up with the idea that you can put seatbelts in cars and that you can prevent deaths by having people safely strapped in.
549-2937 as we speak with the president-elect of the American Medical Association, Dr. Barbara McEnany. And as you pointed out, we've made automobiles safer. We've made a number of other aspects of American life safer over the last century or so. This issue, though, is particularly fraught and divisive. It's a very difficult issue for Americans to discuss and deal with. The Second Amendment is held dear by so many millions of Americans that the kind of changes you're talking about become a non-starter for so many people just because of the politics around this. What do the nation's physicians have to say about how we might break through that impasse?
Well, I think taking it as a public health issue is a good start. No issue should be not discussed because of pre-held conditions. The first step for anything is to have an open mind and to say it is not the goal of gun owners to have our children die with it. We can all start there. And so since that we don't want that to happen anymore, can't we work together to figure out ways that we can prevent these tragedies that occur in dramatic mass shootings, but also occur one student at a time in high schools all across the country? Classes of high school kids die every year, sometimes in mass shootings and sometimes one at a time, and we cannot allow that to continue.
In fact, firearm injuries in this country kill more than 30,000 people each year in the United States. We're certainly an outlier among developed nations when it comes to the amount of deaths due to firearms.
Absolutely. It's a very small number in other countries. The other thing that we have in this country are some of the bump stock issues where we can turn things into automatic weapons. The Las Vegas shooting, all of these shootings could not occur if we didn't have very high-powered rifles. And one of the things that will be discussed at our AMA House of Delegates is whether or not those should be available for the public. That's getting closer to your Second Amendment issues, but it also remains a public health issue for the doctors of the country. We're the ones who have to put people back together in the emergency rooms and in the operating rooms. The Florida pediatricians were originally banned from being able to discuss gun safety and ask the parents of the kids they were treating whether they were safe at home. And they succeeded in getting that law overturned so pediatricians can help keep their patients, the children of Florida, safer. And that's a great step in the right direction.
And if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with the president-elect of the American Medical Association, Dr. Barbara McEnany. The nation's doctors are in Jacksonville this week. It's the 2018 Future of Healthcare Conference today and tomorrow at the Prime Osborne Convention Center. What are your questions? We'll go to your calls in just a moment at 549-2937. Now, in addition to gun violence, you also are giving a talk, Dr. McEnany, about another massive public health problem in this country, the nation's opioid epidemic, another scourge that's claiming thousands and thousands of lives.
Right. More people have died of opioid overdose deaths than have died in the armed services. That, you know, this is another tragedy.
Died in war, yeah.
Yes. This is another tragedy that is affecting people from every socioeconomic class, in every community, and of all age groups, and we really have to address it.
What is the position, or is there an official position from the American Medical Association on what needs to be done to combat opiate abuse in this country?
Yes, in 2014, we established a task force to look at opioid overdoses. Originally, there was a problem because doctors were taught that we're supposed to relieve everyone's pain. And so that
began, pain was the fifth vital sign.
Pain was the fifth vital sign, and we were bad doctors if we didn't relieve people's pain 100%. Well, that's impossible for many people. But we tried, and so we got in the habit of providing more and more of these opioids, and we were being told that they were safe and not addictive, et cetera. Now we've learned, to our dismay, that we have some ownership of this problem because now we have to reverse that. It is a tragedy when people who survive a trauma or survive a difficult surgery end up with an addictive disorder that can potentially take their lives.
And doctors have really tightened up the prescribing of these addictive opioids in recent years. But what else do you think the medical profession could or should be doing?
We think there's several things that need very much to be done. One thing is to have naloxone, which is a drug that is very safe to give, that should be readily available so that people can give it if they see an overdose occurring. It's like CPR for heart attacks. To be able to give this, to be able to have it without prior authorizations from health insurance companies, to be able to make sure that that's available, to allow medication-assisted therapy. We need to look at addiction as a disease and not as a moral failing. We have to say, this is an addictive drug, this person has a chronic relapsing disease, and we need to use the medication that can cut the cravings down so that people do not relapse from that disease.
And if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Dr. Barbara McEnany. She's president-elect of the American Medical Association, in town this week for the 2018 Future of Healthcare Conference in downtown Jacksonville. And we're talking right now about two public health emergencies in this country, gun violence and the opioid epidemic. Let's go to your calls, 549-2937. Mark is on the west side. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Hey, you know, I was listening to you talk, doctor, and as an aside, I'll get to my main topic real quickly. I'm a registered nurse. I've worked at two major hospitals over the last 10 years, and I've been told that doctors were getting educated into talking to people and patients about death and dying, and, you know, it's, you know, we might not want to put your 98-year-old mother on full code, maybe palliative care is best and all that stuff. And I'm not seeing it down there, you know, on the battlefield where I am. Sometimes it's up to me, a nurse, and that's just inappropriate. Yeah, and I've been hearing for years and years and years that doctors were getting more in tune with that, and it was being taught more and more in medical schools, but I just don't see that. So that's something you can take to the bank with. But what I really wanted to speak with about is, you know, you mentioned the mass school shootings. Isn't that more an outlier, I mean, an outcome of the problem of bullying? I mean, isn't 100% just about these kids, you know, the product of, you know, bullying, relentless bullying for years and years and years? I mean, if you want to, you know, stop that problem, that's what you need to look at, I think.
Mark, thanks for the call.
So I think you may have a good point. That may be one of the causes. But I think the important point here is that we don't actually know what are all the causes of these shootings. And that's why we need to have funding to study it. If this were, as I said earlier, an infection that went through and killed this many kids every year, we would be rallying our forces to be able to fight that infection. But we don't really know the cause. If it's bullying, then we need to address that. If it is abuse at home, then we need to address that. There are lots of potential causes.
And looking at the AMA's website, your organization has also called for renewing and strengthening the assault weapons ban, including banning high-capacity magazines, more resources for safety education programs that promote the responsible use and storage of firearms, and a stronger commitment in this country to access to mental health services, among other things.
The mental health services are incredibly important here. We have many states that have mental health parity laws, but so often there are barriers placed by the insurance companies that prevent people from getting the mental health that they need. And then there's the stigma of mental health. And this is an important thing both for opioids and for gun violence, in that there is a stigma to seeking help. Mm-hmm. And we need to stop thinking of these things as separate issues from public health, but look at them as just another disease that we should be able to treat.
Bill in Mandarin. Hey, Bill, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Hey, reason I called, I think what would be useful here in our fight against the gun violence is to make a listing of all the laws that the NRA and state NRAs have proposed to block gathering research data to help cure this problem, and also any laws they've tried to enact that make it worse. I could call back in 1990, the state legislature in Idaho at the NRA urging passed a law to allow the mounting of 50 caliber machine guns on the back of pickup trucks to go hunting. Thank heavens the governor stepped up to the plate and vetoed that. But I think setting a line on what the enemy's doing would help a lot.
Thanks for your call. Doctor.
Well, we don't look at any American as being the enemy. We want to look at every person and be able to see what will make them able to be as healthy as possible. We are actually the doctors of America, so that's our concern. And in talking to people who do a lot of hunting, I have never heard of anyone wanting to hunt a deer with a machine gun. How would you ever get the bullets out of the deer to be able to eat it? So we hunters don't seem to want this, or at least the hunters that I run into and talk to in my home state of New Mexico.
That's right. And just for people that don't know your full background, you are based in Albuquerque. You're an oncologist. You built a cancer center there, and you are the president-elect of the AMA.
Correct.
When do you assume the full role, by the way?
June 12th.
June 12th. So any day now. Lauren in Orange Park. Hi, Lauren. Go ahead.
I was a student in high school, about to turn 18, and I remember that getting access to mental health services was so hard because no one wanted to deal with me. Pediatric doctors didn't want to help me, and then I was a little too young for, you know, adult care, and I remember wanting to give up. I remember thinking it's useless. I'm frustrated, and I don't want to go through this. So if mental health is so important to gun ownership, how do we help adults? Because if they have jobs and kids and everything else, how are they going to find the time and, you know, the encouragement to even maintain their health to own these guns?
Thank you, Lauren.
I think you point out the issue of the lack of ability to access mental health very well. We do not have sufficient numbers of psychiatrists and other mental health professionals in this country. We have insurance rules of prior authorization that limit it, even though there are laws that say that there should be parity of mental health with physical health. The barriers are still there. But the biggest barrier is probably still what people think about it. They don't want to let someone else know that they have a mental health issue, whereas if they had diabetes, they wouldn't hesitate at all to say, oh yeah, I'm diabetic, I have to do this or that. There's a stigma that we're going to have to overcome. And that's something that all of us can participate in. From the physicians, we can do a good bit to make it more accessible. For patients and for family members of people, we need to have a lot of public support for seeing this as not a stigma and a reason not to hire somebody.
That's another part of it, corporate America, isn't it? The workplace. People don't want their colleagues or supervisor maybe to know they're being treated for something like depression or bipolar disorder or anxiety, PTSD, whatever it may be.
Right, because they're concerned that there may be a stigma applied to them there and they may not have the same ability to be advanced in their job or to be considered for that next promotion. So we really need to reverse our thinking in this country. And that the doctors can start that, but every person needs to search their soul and think about that one.
What can the AMA do as a body to make mental health care more accessible?
We've done a fair amount in trying to push for mental health parity laws. Now we would like to push to have enforcement of those mental health parity laws. In particular, in the opioid area, we need to be able to have more medical schools teaching addiction medicine, teaching the students who will be the doctors of the future how to manage pain in such a way that we don't create those problems. And many primary care practices across the country are starting to embed mental health care in their primary care offices, so it's just part of the continuum of getting care. Mm-hmm. And I think that will do a lot to destigmatize it.
Let's go to a few of your tweets and emails. Susie emails the show, "This year will mark 28 years since Jacksonville experienced a workplace shooting. June 18th, 1990, the GMAC shooting. Many don't remember it. My husband worked for GMAC. Luckily, we were on vacation that day, but he lost his manager and his coworkers. This shooting needs to be remembered since it's one of the reasons the open office, an office at least without some protective shields, no longer exists." Susie, thanks for that reminder. Here is a tweet from Brian. "All this talk of arming teachers ignores attacks that are happening everywhere. Do theater ushers and church deacons all need special ops training?" Michael tweets the show, "As long as the NRA continues to buy politicians and their votes, we will continue to allow our children to be sacrificed to the money of the gun industry. Nothing will be done as long as the same politicians hold our country hostage." And there are some comments on Facebook as well. Brian, "What is the AMA's position on a comprehensive solution to gun violence hitting our schools, theaters, and houses of worship? For you, Doctor, it begins, as you said at the top of the hour, I think, with freeing up federal dollars to further study the issue and gather data. Is that the most important issue for you?"
That's the starting point. I don't think it's the most important, but it's certainly the place we have to start. You know, when we're treating somebody, the thing we do first is make the diagnosis before we start a treatment. So that's what we need to do in this. We know what the outcome is, that our children are dying. We need to figure out how we can intervene most effectively.
Ben has been holding. He's on the South Side. Hi, Ben. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm calling basically to obviously, mental health is a big problem young people in school and stuff, and we could have more counselors and we could have more resource officers available to help students that have mental health issues. I think that part of living in a free society comes with some risk, and we are not acknowledging the fact that our schools are just open to anybody that can walk in. Most high schools these days, there's a dozen entrances. We keep our banks secure. We keep our jewelry store secure with buzzers on the doors. I think we really need to be realistic and put some funding into keeping our kids, students safe behind locked doors. You know, I lock my doors at night with my kids in my house, and I wouldn't want them to be exposed during the day either.
Thanks, Ben. You know, after the shooting in South Florida at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, the Florida legislature did pass a law that does include additional funding for increased security at our schools, increased mental health services for students. There were some other measures in that piece of legislation. But, you know, the lieutenant governor of Texas is coming under fire this morning for saying that the problem is that there are too many doors to the nation's schools, and that they should only have one door in and one door out that can be fully secured. For you, I think that might be a doctor obscuring the issue. Am I correct in saying that?
Well, I think you're correct in saying that. I would also worry what would happen. Would that meet the fire code? I think there are other risks to students that may preclude the idea of one door. If there is a shooter in the school and there's only one door to get out, that might make it harder rather than easier. And that's exactly a good point in why we need to study these issues and come up with some logical, sensible solutions to say, who's right here? Maybe one size doesn't fit all. But I will also add that in other countries, they don't have this much of an issue. And I personally would, thinking back to my own childhood, the idea that I would have to be locked up as if I were the criminal in a school system is a sad way to look at childhood.
This is just a short preview of the talk you're going to be giving today at the Future of Healthcare Conference at the Prime Osborne Convention Center. She is the president-elect of the American Medical Association as the nation's doctors come to Jacksonville this week to talk about the most pressing public issues in this country, gun violence, the nation's opioid epidemic, mental health, and also something we didn't even get into, doctor, obesity. That's another big problem in America. So, you know, we know you have a busy schedule this week, so we really thank you for spending some time on the radio with us this morning. Thanks for stopping by.
Well, I'm very impressed with this foundation of gathering together a bunch of community leaders and all of the hospitals in the community and concerned citizens and saying, what are the topics that you think we should be addressing as physicians, as healthcare providers? And I think that I commend this organization for putting together such a great talk.
Thank you so much for that. She's Dr. Barbara McEnany, president-elect of the AMA. And still ahead, we're going to continue our discussion of gun violence in America. Stay on the line if you're on hold. In a moment, we'll hear what trauma surgeons and EMTs have to say as we mark National EMS Week. That's right after this. Back in a moment.
Community hospice and palliative care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours. Available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
ViStar Credit Union is a financial cooperative focused on delivering quality financial services for its members. ViStar, we never forget that it's your money. Information available at 777-6000 or on the web at vistarcu.org.
Hi, I'm Andrew Wickman, host of Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues is now on twice a week. Blues Horizon, Monday and Wednesday nights at 11, right here on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
What's up?
The WJCT HD4 pop-up jazz station is now on the air. The Jacksonville Jazz Festival is almost here, so swing out with jazz 24 hours a day on 89.9 HD4 until the jazz festival ends. Like what you hear? Send your comments to music@wjct.org and enjoy the WJCT HD4 pop-up jazz station.
Hi, I'm WJCT News Director Jessica Palumbo. As you listen to 89.9, we want to make sure we're listening to you. What do you want to hear more of, less of? How do you listen most? On your radio? Streaming online? Help make sure WJCT stays relevant to you by taking our less than 10-minute audience survey. You can do it right now at WJCT.org. We're listening.
Okay. Welcome back. We are continuing our discussion now on America's gun violence epidemic. From the point of view of the nation's trauma surgeons and EMTs, they will tell you that firearm injuries kill more than 30,000 people each year in the United States. In fact, since 1968, more people in this country have died of civilian firearm injuries than deaths from every war the U.S. has ever fought. UF Health here in Jacksonville sees more than 4,000 trauma patients every year. Of these, approximately 400 have suffered gunshot wounds. More than half of them are seriously injured, and about 10% of them will die of those injuries. Now, Solid Data supports the safe storage of firearms like gun locks and safes to decrease injuries. That translates to a 75% reduction in suicides and unintentional injuries. UF Health and Trauma One here in Jacksonville is distributing 40 free firearm cable locks this week to secure home firearms. These are usable for both handguns and rifles. And all of this is important to note because this week is actually National EMS Week. It's a week set aside to honor America's emergency medical technicians and paramedics and the life-saving duties they perform. Dr. Marie Crandall is a UF trauma surgeon at UF Health Jacksonville, and she's also Flight Services Deputy Medical Director for Injury Prevention and Research. She joins us now with more about gun violence in America and EMS Week. Dr. Crandall, thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
And we'll go to some more calls on this in a moment at 549-2937. So this week is EMS Week. EMTs and paramedics are the unsung heroes of the medical profession. The work they do is so important. Let's begin by discussing briefly why we want to take a moment to honor these men and women.
Absolutely. And the EMTs, particularly Jacksonville Fire and Rescue, Liberty Ambulance Services, the ambulance services around Jacksonville do an outstanding job of first response to sometimes dangerous scenes to help Jacksonville Sheriff's Office secure a scene and to evacuate seriously injured patients.
Right. And it can mean so often the difference between life and death, their skills, their commitment. Now, you're a trauma surgeon and as I mentioned, UF Health and Trauma One is the place where patients are most often taken in this city if someone is a trauma patient or if they've suffered a gunshot wound. Trauma surgeons are really vocal about this problem because they see the carnage that's inflicted by guns in this country. What do you see in your trauma center?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. We, as a member of many national organizations, the American Association for Surgery of Trauma, Eastern Association for Surgery of Trauma, I have been an advocate for gun violence prevention and firearm injury prevention. We've also, me and my colleagues, have written several evidence-based reviews evaluating the data that does exist. Dr. McEnany was a very eloquent speaker in terms of saying we need to repeal, or a first step would be to repeal the Dickey Amendment and to be able to fund gun violence prevention research. We do, however, have pretty good data that there are some things that can help decrease the toll that this is taking on our communities.
What are some common sense things that you would like to see happen?
Well, we recently published a study looking at the effect of safe storage and gun locks on things like suicide, teen suicide, and unintentional injuries. And we found that all of those strategies have been shown from retrospective studies and case control studies to be effective in decreasing the toll of violence. In fact, guns that are stored, loaded, and unlocked in those households, there's a 4 times increased risk of youth suicide and suicide. So simply by keeping your guns unloaded and locked or safely stored, you can prevent a death.
JSO has been conducting a campaign for some time in this city, reminding people at 9 o'clock at night to secure your weapon if you have one, take it out of your vehicle if you've left it there. I just wanted to make note of that as well. At the same time, you at UF Health and Trauma One are distributing free firearm cable locks to the community. Can you tell us about that?
We are. We've partnered with manufacturers for these cable locks that are appropriate for both handguns as well as rifles, which is something that not all gun locks are able to do. And if you're interested in getting one for your gun, you can either contract us at Trauma One, and that's the number one, Trauma One at jax.ufl.edu, or call 904-244-3400 and ask for a gun lock and responsible gun ownership security measures to be mailed to you.
What's the worst situation you've seen in the surgical center at Trauma One from gun injuries?
Well, this is interesting. So I started my training at Martin Luther King in South Central Los Angeles prior to the assault weapons ban and the Brady Bill. And we routinely saw kids come in with 50 holes in them.
What was that like to see that for you?
It was crippling. It was terrible. It was destroying a community. And as you know, Los Angeles has made dramatic strides using community development and some more stringent gun law restrictions, as opposed to states that did not embrace that. So Los Angeles has had a dramatic decrease in their violent crime and homicide rate, nearly 80%. And we know that those strategies work. So in states that have more restrictive gun licensing, there are fewer firearm-related homicides and suicides and unintentional injuries. But we saw the effect of the Brady Bill, among many things, and the assault weapons ban. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms estimated that prior to those laws, about 17% of firearm-related assaults were committed by assault weapons, as opposed to afterwards, like 10 years later, it was down to less than 2%. So there was an effect. One of the problems with the Dickey Amendment is that it became globally applied. So we don't have those numbers for now, after the sunset of the assault weapons ban. But what I'm seeing in the last few years I was in Chicago, and now that I've been in Jacksonville, is that we're seeing more high-capacity magazines, more high-caliber rounds that we really didn't see for probably 15 years.
How does Jacksonville compare to what you saw in Chicago, which, of course, is notorious for having a problem with gun violence?
Absolutely. I mean, the endemic gun violence in every community destroys individuals, destroys their families, and destroys the community. And I think that other sensible strategies that we'd like to look at, and it would be ideal to have funding to help do this on a global scale, is look at community-based violence prevention measures. A recent study found that in communities that addressed urban blight, violence and violent crimes went down, as well as decrease in acceptability of violence among community members. So there are many things that we can do from a community development standpoint that can help decrease gun violence, in addition to talking about the vector.
The vector meaning?
Oh, sorry. The public health approach to a problem, any sort of disease, is looking at the host, the vector, and the environment. And the host would be the person or individuals. The vector would be a gun in this case, and the environment would be America.
So you're defining the vector or the gun as the disease.
It's part of a description of a disease, yes. So like for HIV, the host would be the person, the vector would be the virus, and then the environment would be the location or the setting of this happening. And there are things that are unique in the environment in the United States. For example, poor funding of schools or poor mental health services. And I would say an increased acceptability of interpersonal violence, but the host issues really don't differ from other developed countries. There's no more mental illness. There's no more bullying. There's no, in fact, in some other countries like Scotland, violent crime rates, interpersonal violence are higher than that of the United States. But obviously, deaths related to gun violence and homicides are much lower in those countries. So the real difference is in it from a disease perspective, but from a public health perspective, is this vector, which is the firearm.
All right, let's go to some calls now as we mark National EMS Week, Emergency Medical Services Week, honoring the nation's trauma surgeons and EMTs and paramedics. We're talking about gun violence in America with Dr. Marie Crandall at UF's Trauma 1-549-2937. Chuck at the beaches. Chuck, you call a lot talking about opioids, and I appreciate your thoughts on that issue as well. What are your thoughts right now?
Well, I was going to say that on my hip right now is a Narcan, which is an opioid medicine for someone who overdoses, and I carry it on my hip 24 hours a day. Now, as far as the firearms go, unfortunately, you mentioned Scotland, where they have a high rate of crime and things. There's a term that's called disparity of force. And for someone who, like a woman or someone, doesn't have the opportunity to stop someone who's going to assault her and maybe cause her serious bodily injury unless she has a firearm. So a firearm is like a chainsaw. I wish I didn't have to carry one. It's no fun.
You don't have to carry one.
Well, if I don't carry one and my wife and I are attacked or someone breaks into my home like that man that just broke into the house and assaulted that woman in front of her father, I'm not going to lose that fight. I'm going to win that one if I can. And that's what disparity of force is, and that's why you have to have something to stop that kind of thing. And so, I mean, that's a choice people make. As far as I'm concerned, I'm 66 years old, and I can't stop two men that weigh 200 pounds if they try to break into my car and assault my wife unless I have a firearm. And I'm going to win that if I can. I am not going to lose that battle if I can avoid it. But back to the Narcan and the firearms and things, they're tools. I wish I didn't have to carry them. But unless you can make those guys go away, and you mentioned Scotland, what do you do in Scotland if you're a woman and a man tries to sexually assault you? You're going to lose that battle. But here in America, in Florida, we have 1,500,000 concealed carry permits. And those women who have those firearms have that opportunity to win that assault.
All right. Thanks for the call. I'm going to have Dr. Crandall answer you. Thank you for that. Go ahead.
Thank you so much for bringing that up. I think that's a really important point. And it's one that most Americans care about. I need a firearm for personal protection. And that actually has been studied. So, in fact, concealed carry permits have been studied. And there have been several studies. We actually did an evidence-based review looking at them. We did not find that there was any impact on overall crime rates in states with concealed carry laws. So there were some studies that showed maybe it helped. There were about 7 or 8 studies that showed nothing, and then there were a couple that showed that crime rates actually increased. So while the idea of concealed carry is attractive, it does not seem to be borne out in terms of making an impact on overall crime rates. What's more, a study that was published in American Journal of Public Health a few years ago looked at concealed carry permit holders in Texas and found that while they were less likely to be perpetrators of petty crime, they were more likely to be perpetrators of violent crime, particularly crimes with firearms, like aggravated assault, aggravated rape. So I don't know about the concealed carry thing. I think it's interesting, and we should study it again. A call for the appeal of the Dickey Amendment. With respect to personal safety, the truth is this has been studied as well, and Art Kellerman looked at this specifically, and looking at large-scale national data sets found that in homes with weapons—
You're actually less safe. That's what you're getting to. Is that
four times more likely to have that gun used against
you're
you?
You're more likely to have it used against you than to ward off a home invader.
At least four times more likely.
Yeah, and it's interesting. A study in the journal Scientific American notes that overwhelmingly Americans believe that more firearms will keep more people safe when in reality, huge data sets, at least the ones that have been able to be collected, show the opposite.
That's exactly right. And it's frustrating for those of us who research it and who know the data.
And you work in this. And for me, it seems almost like believing that you're safer driving somewhere than flying, when even though you know statistically you're that flying is safer than driving, you're more likely to be killed in an auto accident. But you have the illusion of control when you're driving on the road. So I guess that's what it comes down to, feeling that you're in control if you have the weapon, or at least believing that you are, even if you really aren't fully in control of the situation. But Dr. Marie Crandall of UF Trauma One, we thank you so much for joining us as we talk about this issue, and we hope you'll come back.
Thank you very much.
It's National EMS Week. Just take a moment to thank the nation's EMTs and trauma surgeons for the amazing work that they do in America. And in a moment, Culpepper, as the Jaguars get ready to kick off those off-season workouts.
Community hospice and palliative care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours, available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
Vistar Credit Union, committed to helping its members understand their home loan options and make informed choices. Vistar, we never forget that it's your money. Information available at 777-6000 or vistarcu.org.
Florida historians and their students are creating innovative digital resources. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with some of the state's leading digital historians about the future of history. We'll discuss a letter from 1884 and the Tequesta Indians of Southeast Florida. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Chabon has a new collection of essays called Pops, Fatherhood in Pieces. It features a story about taking his 13-year-old son to Paris Fashion Week, which became a viral sensation online, and meditations on the complicated relationships between fathers and children. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Gambling on professional sports could be coming to your town. The Supreme Court just cleared the way for states to legalize it. Now the race is on to regulate this new multi-billion dollar industry, and states are acting quickly. But what are the odds that Congress will get involved too? Sports betting, next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, the Jaguars are ready to kick off those off-season workouts.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Hopes of a Super Bowl championship are still alive for Team Teal. Culpepper's on the line now with a look at that and the rest of the week's sports news and notes. Hey, Cole.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. Yeah, you said the real key, and it's something that really hasn't happened, I would say going back maybe to 2000, and that is that the Jaguars are beginning their off-season practices, their OTAs, the organized team activities, with thoughts of a Super Bowl championship as the goal for a season. And if you go back to Tom Coughlin's era when he was the head coach, there were some of those kind of seasons somewhat routinely. But I don't think we can honestly say that the Jaguars have entered the off-season work getting ready for a new year thinking that the Lombardi Trophy would be at the end of the rainbow for them. And this is exactly what they're looking at this year. These OTAs, the organized team activities, begin tomorrow. They're closed to the public, but it's the first time that all the rookies and veterans will be on the field together. No tackling, no pads, but it does provide an opportunity for everybody to be out there. Here are some of the things I'll be looking for as the Jaguars get their practices underway. First, how do the rookies look? Other than some video provided by the team in the rookie minicamp last week. But now we'll see them, see how they interact with the veterans. We'll see. I mean, they're just, some of them are going to look lost. I mean, it's just the way it's going to be. But how do they look in general, particularly the draft picks, to keep a close eye on? Number two, some of the free agents. The Jaguars signed some big-name free agents in the offseason, not the least of which being guard Andrew Norwell. It's going to be tough to see how Norwell is doing again because it's not a full contact situation, and usually the linemen you've got to see in how they are in a more physical setting. But guys like Dante Moncrief, the wide receiver, be able to see how he looks. Does he look the part to become a contributor on the wide receiving court? And then finally, and maybe most notably, does Blake Bortles look like he has improved? He spent the offseason working out in California with some cornerback gurus. He's coming off having his off-season surgery, should be completely healthy and ready to go. And we're going to want to see how the quarterback does as the Jaguars hit the field starting tomorrow. And they'll have several weeks worth of off-season practices, usually two or three practice sessions per week, spread out between now and June. And then training camp will get going in late July.
What else is on your agenda this week, Cole? Let's talk about softball. It's been the worst weather for softball.
Yeah, it has been a real challenge for not only high school but also college to get all the games in. In fact, the Gators playing for a spot in the Super Regional, which is the last step before the Women's College World Series, had to wait 7 hours to get their game going yesterday. But Florida State, and Georgia have all won their way into the Super Regionals with wins yesterday. And it's possible that all three schools could wind up in the Women's College World Series because they don't play each other in the Super Regionals, which is just a two out of three series with those in order to move on to Oklahoma City, where the Women's College World Series is played. And rain created some real hazard as well. The softball state championships in the Final Four. The most interesting matchup, though, involves two local teams, Keystone Heights against West Nassau. West Nassau's coach is not going to be there. They were going to play last week, and they got a pushback twice, and now finally they're going to play tomorrow. There's a pretty good situation, pretty good excuse, I should say, for not being there. She's due to deliver her baby on Tuesday, so I guess that's an excuse absence, right?
Yes.
When you're ready to deliver, and so the two teams are set to play tomorrow, and I really can't think of a better reason to miss than a shot at the state semifinals.
That's exciting. I hope all goes well with that. And last but not least, the Armada have an important match coming up Wednesday in Tampa, Cole.
Well, this past Wednesday in Jacksonville, they beat Tampa on what they call the most important match of the season. They won 1-0, and with the win, they get on to the third round of the U.S. Open Cup. They're going to face Miami United on Wednesday. And if they win that one, they'll wind up taking on an MLS side in the fourth round, possibly Orlando City. And it's doubly important for the Armada this year because they're playing down a league with some of the teams in the North American Soccer League postponing their season. The Armada wanted to keep playing, so they have to find quality matches. And to play a team like Tampa Bay, who's a second-division team, or to play a first-division team like Orlando City, these are very important not only for the players to be able to show what they have, but just in general for the club to be able to show, hey, even though we're playing down league, we still can compete with the best teams in the country. So they'll play at JU on Wednesday against Miami United, and then we'll find out in the days following who that MLS matchup could be if they win.
Cole, always good to talk to you. And the jumbo shrimp were rained out, but they have a doubleheader today starting at 11. Hopefully clear skies for that. Thanks, Cole, as always. Appreciate you catching us up on sports.
Thanks, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. And if you're catching our rebroadcast tonight at 8 p.m., keep listening for Electro Lounge.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.